Welcome to Famous People You've Never Heard Of, the podcast brought to you by Blue Fire Theatre Company. Each episode is devoted to the discovery of someone once well-renowned and now no longer recognised. We've made it our mission to try to keep the stars of yesterday burning bright and to remember those people in danger of being lost to history. If you enjoy our podcast, do subscribe via your provider so that we'll be a little more visible and you'll never miss an episode. I'm Lottie Walker, and it's my pleasure to spend some time with all these wonderful people. I hope you enjoy meeting them too.
Welcome back to Famous People You've Never Heard Of, where today we are going to talk about Avril Coleridge Taylor. And back in the Zoom room, we've got, for the first time ever, a return visitor. Welcome back, the marvellous Stephen Bourne. Hurrah, lovely to see you.
Thank you. I'm more than happy to be back.
So, Avril Coleridge Taylor, daughter of Samuel Coleridge Taylor, both musicians, composers.
She was a conductor as well. She was a woman conductor at a time when that was unusual. So everything she did was as a trailblazer for women and for women of colour. But she's sadly missing from the history books. She's glaringly not there. And that's always been my life's work. Uncovering as much information as I can about these missing people that shouldn't be missing from history.
She was English.
Yeah, she was born in London in 1903, so British through and through. Her father was the famous composer Samuel Coleridge Taylor, who was of mixed heritage. His father was West African from Sierra Leone, and his mother was British, white, so he was mixed race. He married an English woman, Jessie. Avril was born after her brother, Hiawatha. Hiawatha, her brother, was born in 1900, so he was about 3 years older than her. And Hiawatha was named after Samuel Coleridge Taylor's most famous composition, Hiawatha's Wedding Feast, which played a very important role in Avril's life later on. I'm not sure the exact date, but it would have been, I think, the 1890s that Hiawatha's Wedding Feast was launched. But it was an extraordinarily popular music piece that Samuel and then later Avril conducted many, many times. I think it was performed annually, long after his death in 1912. It was performed regularly at the Albert Hall and other concert places. And sometimes Avril would take part either as a singer or later as a conductor.
There's such publicity now about how few female conductors there are even now. To have been doing that in sort of the 30s or whatever.
She was a trailblazer in many respects. Her father died in 1912, and that was the first year she wrote her own composition. So she's only young. She's only about 9 years old. And her first composition was Goodbye Butterfly. And because of her own musical talent, and partly also because of her father's name and fame and respect in the music world, she studied music at the Trinity College in London, pianoforte, composition, singing. And this was all through the sort of First World War. And also during the First World War, she's going off and singing in concerts to the troops. She was quite diverse in her musical ability early on. And she had the utmost love and respect for her father's memory. And so she was keen to continue promoting him. But in her own right, aside from her father's influence, she conducted various orchestras, the BBC Symphony Orchestra, the Royal Marines, and she, right through the sort of 30s and 40s, and at the same time composing. She never stopped composing music. Songs and orchestral pieces, that the heartbreaking thing for me about Avril is that hardly any recordings exist. Nothing of her music is available on CD. There have been recent postings on YouTube who have rediscovered her music and have started playing the piano music. Her father, there's lots of CDs of his compositions. In Britain, there's still this reluctance to accept a woman of colour who was British born doing this fabulous work. So where Florence Price, the African-American woman composer, has been rediscovered, she's pretty much the same generation as Avril. It's still the African-Americans that get the full attention. And I don't have a problem with that, but it is at the expense of the Black British. And we still seem to be very slow at restoring women like Avril. It's not right that their music exists in sheet music form, but you can't hear it. Also, the world of classical music, concert music, is very elitist and very white, middle class dominated. So I think they're very precious about who they choose and who they select. That's not to say there aren't now Black classical music composers and musicians around, but they're still, on balance, still favouring the African-Americans. Avril herself did experience a lot of prejudice in the music world, partly because of her colour, partly because she was a woman. And so in her time, she's at her peak in the sort of 1920s and 30s and part of the 1940s, she's still being discriminated against in the world of classical music because it was so white male dominated. It certainly wore her down, so that by the 1950s, when she was in her 50s, she had a breakdown and withdrew a bit. She did continue composing. She lived until 1998, so she was about 95 when she passed away. But there was not one obituary of her. Well, after I found out that she'd passed away, I ordered a copy of her death certificate. And on her death certificate, the informant was her son, Nigel. And so I wrote to him and we struck up a correspondence. We spoke on the phone. He gave me a lot of insights into his mother's psychology and how troubled she was by the discrimination. And but also she was a very difficult woman to deal with because she felt, as the daughter of Samuel Coleridge Taylor, she should be given greater recognition. I just hope that in the future that more recognition will be given to her, because of the little fragments of music of hers that I have now heard, only in recent times, the orchestral music is beautiful. She was offered work in South Africa. This was in the 1950s, and she's not getting so much work in Britain at that time. It's beginning to dry up. So she accepts this lucrative offer to go and teach and work in South Africa. I think it was Johannesburg. And as she explains in her autobiography, she did have empathy with the Black South Africans. She was given a servant and they had a very good relationship, but she did consciously hide the fact that she was of mixed ancestry. And then eventually somebody in authority discovered who her father was. And it was horrible because she wasn't deported. She was told to leave the country immediately. And if she hadn't, she would have been arrested.
She went on, didn't she, after that, to do the Independence Day music for Ghana, which is a really nice thing.
Yes, exactly. Which is a kind of flip side of the South Africa trip. In 1957, Ghana became independent and she was asked to write a piece of music for their Independence Day celebrations. And that would have come from her name. I mean, they would have known who Samuel Coleridge Taylor was and that she was his daughter. She had two marriages, I believe. And I don't think either of them lasted very well.
She didn't have a very happy life, bless her, did she, really?
I think she had a happy life insofar as she managed to, in her heyday, before the war particularly, in the 20s and 30s, she was given opportunities, especially women of colour, were not given in this country. So I think it's when she got older and perhaps more ambitious that she started to get knocked back. So her period of great achievements ended after about 20 years. So that, as I say, by the 1950s, she's struggling to get the recognition that she felt that she deserved. I did go to the BBC written archives and looked at her files. Her files are really thick. And there's letter after letter after letter from Avril asking for work. This is from the sort of end of the war, 1945 onwards. And it gets quite depressing when you get 10 years on and she's still writing these almost like begging letters, reminding the BBC of who she is. But there is beginning now much more interest in Black British history and people of colour in Britain than has ever been. People are more interested in this country, in the Black Britons, than they are in the African Americans, because they realize now more than ever that we have a history in this country. And so, if I may plug my next book, I've recently finished a children's version of Black Poppies, which was the World War I book I did about Black community in Britain in the First World War and the servicemen in the First World War. But Avril and Hiawatha have a chapter, a section to themselves. And there's a photograph of Hiawatha that I believe has never been used before, never been published, in his Red Cross World War I uniform. And so I've told their World War I story in the book. We need to hear her music. We need to listen to it for pleasure. We need to reevaluate it. We need to analyse it. We need to place her in the canon, as they say.
Well, thank you very much. It's been so nice to speak to you again. And don't forget, everybody out there, new book coming out, Black Poppies, children's version. Black Poppies, adult version is already out there and it's marvellous. I've read it. So thanks again, Stephen Bourne. It's been lovely to meet you.
Thank you.
It's always such a pleasure to talk to Stephen. And now for our last word today, here's author and musician Patricia Hammond.
So I discovered the music of Avril Coleridge Taylor when I was a student and collecting sheet music. It's kind of an unconventional way of discovering music, I guess. I collected sheet music because it was, well, a way for a student to be able to have music and not pay too much money for it if you look through old music stacks. But in old music stacks, you find some pretty fascinating things and an insight into the past and music history that is kind of different. So in doing that, I discovered a lot of what's so-called parlor music that was meant for kind of domestic consumption at home to play and sing. And in this way, I discovered a whole bunch of women composers, because women composers really dominated that field. And that is, in fact, what my book is about. And in it, I do have a chapter on Avril Coleridge Taylor. The piece of music that I originally had way back then was by Gwendolyn Coleridge Taylor. And I saw it and I thought, ooh, is she related to the famous, you know, Samuel Coleridge Taylor, who, of course, legend, and a very, very fascinating person in music history. And so I had to wait a few years before I was old enough. This was before the internet, and I was living in a small town, before I was old enough to properly explore somebody as really, in those days, obscure as that. And I eventually found out that, yeah, Gwendolyn Coleridge Taylor was the daughter of Samuel Coleridge Taylor. And she changed her name later on to Avril after she'd had her divorce and she started a new life. And that was really kind of, if you look at her life, that was a real theme that runs throughout, is the theme of identity, changing your identity, changing your style, changing who you are. And her identity as a mixed race woman in Britain was something that caused her a lot of torment over the years. Of course, she was very, very dedicated to her father. She absolutely loved him as a child. And then when he died, when she was so young, his death haunted her forever. And she would arrive late at school because she'd always go by way of the cemetery where he was buried on her bicycle and sort of spend some time with him. And she wanted to keep his legacy alive very, very much, and was happy to give interviews about him and about his music and to conduct his music. She was a phenomenal conductor. She conducted his works. She conducted other works. She actually wore a white dress made by Norman Hartnell, who was the dressmaker for Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother and our late Queen, in white, so that she would stand out against all the black of all the tuxedo-clad orchestra, and very proudly a woman conductor standing out in her beautiful dress. But the thing is if you listen to her recordings of her as a conductor, she's a phenomenal conductor. She gets her orchestras to play with passion and with incredible kind of depth and shape and just It's really, really amazing. If you know the repertoire that she's conducting, you just hear that she really had it. She could make them do what she wanted, and she could shape the pieces of music the way she wanted them to be, which was exciting. And it's such a big, huge shame that none of the ensembles that she conducted, she never really was recorded commercially that I know. Identity was really her big thing. And while she was a huge advocate of her father's music and his legacy and a great proponent of it as a performer and as a conductor and as a musician and as a public person too, she still wanted to have her music seen for its own merits. So she also wrote under a pseudonym of Peter Riley. And this quest to find an audience that wouldn't immediately deflect any kind of interrogation into who she was and what her music was into a discussion about her father, she found a very interesting place to go to for this, and that was South Africa. So she discovered that in Southern Africa, perhaps for obvious reasons, I don't know, they didn't know about her father. So she not only passed as white, because she did look quite pale, and it was a sort of don't ask, don't tell. They thought she was white. They loved her music, and they heaped all these commissions on her. So she was going to perform, she was going to conduct, she was going to compose for their ballet, for their broadcasting corporation. And so she sold up everything in Britain, and she went there to start this career in music. And unfortunately, she chose to go on the first Comet jet flight from London to Johannesburg. And it was in the news. It was everywhere that these passengers were going to go on this new mode of travel. And everybody on that flight was in the news and all about them. And so the people in Southern Africa, they saw that she was a daughter of a famous composer of color. And this was not what they thought originally. And so when she arrived, all of her offers of work just dried up and she had nothing to go back to. So she was destitute. It was a really hairy situation. And she also felt remorse at having passed as white because she was, of course, incredibly keen on civil rights and, you know, equality. She thought her idea was that she could get famous there and get well known and then come out and then effect change from within. This was her plan. So it was a real, real setback, so much so that she hardly composed again after she returned to Britain. So again, the subject of identity with Avril Coleridge Taylor. Her music too, it's always questing between different keys. It modulates a lot. It's passionate. It's turbulent. It's tonal, which makes the passion and the turbulence all that more noticeable. You know, if you're doing something that's quite atonal, as was the trend at the time, 1950s, 1940s, that sort of thing isn't so noticeable. But when you write tunes and tunes change key and do that sort of thing, it's all the more obvious. And her stuff, it really pulls no punches. I kind of say that it's almost like kind of wartime tortured Vaughan Williams. And she also admired French Impressionism. So she really went for all sorts of creative, you know, modes. Very, very interesting style. Very interesting style. Hard to pin down, which is always difficult when you're talking about music history, because critics love a label. And she is really hard to pin down. And that is part of the whole business of identity. It just comes back in her case. I really think she makes a fascinating study. In terms of recording Can Sorrow Find Me, I thought that that would be the one to go with the book. She wrote the songs because it reflects the whole theme of identity that she has. And the poem, it's quite a nice little poem. Minnie Aumônier, she was a painter and poet, and she was part of this kind of Hampstead-based North London kind of intellectual scene. And her poems, they talk about gardens and trees a lot. And her lovely paintings were displayed at the Royal Horticultural Society. You can still see her stuff there. I went. And it looks really pleasant on the pages. It looks like a nice little poem. Can sorrow find me in this far-off spot, hidden in bluebell mist? And it's lovely. Avril Coleridge Taylor, whom I think must have known Minnie Aumônier personally because that was part of her thing. She joined that kind of group up there in North London when she changed her name and she moved. She makes this poem into this agonized exploration of trying to hide your identity, trying to never be touched again by your trauma. And when Andrea Kometsova, who's a pianist in the track and whom we work together a lot, when we sight read it, we looked at each other in shock at the end. The first thing she said, what happened to her? Because you can really hear this incredible tortured soul through this song. It's quite extraordinary, and it does all the things that her music seems to like to do. Chases itself and goes into different worlds and explores in this kind of restless way, like it's kind of trapped. It's very well, you can hear how it goes out. Mr. Sun is a lot more like a parlor song of her youth when she was a teenager. She always would compose because she saw her father do it, and he would give her manuscript papers, a little girl, to sit next to him while he composed in his music room, and she would write. So this was something she learned almost from the cradle. And Mr. Sun is very sweet. The lyrics, the poem is by Kathleen Eastman, who was a fascinating lady. Kathleen Eastman Samango. And she came from what is now Ghana, and she died tragically young of appendicitis. But she was part of a kind of an African-British intelligentsia scene that was around at the time, and particularly in South London. And you had the Aldridges, and you had all of these people, and that the Eastman family. And so it's two young women of color in Britain writing a poem and a song, and it's just really sweet.
I'm off to bed now, Mr. Song, and I see you're going to bed down there in the sky. So I'll say good night.
Thank you for listening. You can find further information about our guests and the people we've been speaking about on the show notes. We do hope you've enjoyed the podcast, and if you have, please give us a review online and subscribe via your provider. It really does make a difference. If you like what we do and would like to help us in our work and to keep the podcast going, you might like to consider becoming a patron. It's really easy to do. Just go to patreon.com/bluefiretheatre. Or, if you prefer to make a one-off donation, you can do so on our website, bluefiretheatre.co.uk, or buy us a coffee at coffee.com. That's ko-fi.com/bluefiretheatre. Even the smallest donation helps us take our shows on the road and keep the lights on in the studio. We really appreciate and are so grateful for all your support. And finally, don't forget to follow us on social media. We'd love to hear from you. Look for Blue Fire Theatre Company on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.